Save big money on your outdoor project now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth, so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP, lawn and garden, and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today and view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals. Save big money at Menards.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 483 of the Columbia Calling podcast. Before we go over to our Columbia News Brief with Emily Hart, just to give you a heads up about this episode, our very special guest is Ricardo Cubides. He is the regional director for CODES, which is an NGO. It deals with displacements and human rights here in Colombia, but he's the regional director for the Caribbean region. And we're discussing, well, I guess, the history of the Canal del Dique. And now, for those of you who don't know what the Canal del Dique is, it's a stretch of water built, obviously, on the sweat and blood and backs of the original African slaves to Colombia under the auspices and control of the Spanish Empire. And it connects the wetlands of the Magdalena River to Cartagena. So a very key piece of infrastructure along the Magdalena River. And of course, from henceforth, a very strategic point. Now, this part of Colombia has been much disputed. The conflict continues. Unfortunately, it's connected to the Montes de Maria, which you know that I've spoken about with Angie Lederach some weeks ago when we talk about Hear the Grass Grow, her book there. So, of course, you can refer back to that for further background. But Ricardo speaks to us in clear English, maybe not fluent, but clear English. A couple of times he switches into Spanish and I'll translate. But it's an important interview. It's an important story about things that are underreported. I think we always need to consider these stories as well, the underreported stories in Colombia. So please bear with us on this episode. Do listen to it. And remember that Ricardo is only speaking to us because the interview is in English. Were he to say it all in Spanish and were to get out further, he would be in trouble. He would be in trouble with whomever is in control of this area in Colombia. So let me just get that out there. He says it's in English, and so therefore it won't attract as much attention nationally, but hopefully the story can get out there a bit more internationally through you, the listeners. And of course, context can be given if you go back to the episode, maybe 5-6 episodes ago, with Angela or Angie Lederach talking about the Montes de Maria. So it's a fantastic episode, perhaps not the most upbeat episode, but a fantastic episode. We have other great, great episodes in the pipeline. A couple of authors in the line. I know that Emily's lined up two authors. And I'm also investigating the topic of Mennonites and the Mennonite communities in Colombia. So not, you know, another story not widely reported. Thank you again to our sponsors, Latin News, BNB Colombia Tours, and of course Erin Donaldson, who has been sponsoring this month as well, the Coffee Axis Travel, and she's based there in the Coffee Axis. So we'll go over now to Emily Hart with the Colombia News Brief, and then we'll be back with Ricardo Cubides. And I know you've enjoyed the last couple of episodes, especially the one with Sebastian Ospina talking about being a champion paraglider and, of course, a Colombian flying for Team GB. So there you go. You can support us, as always, on Patreon. That's www.patreon.com/Columbia Calling. All right, now over to Emily. Don't go away. The Columbia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. We are also sponsored by BNB Columbia Tours, which is a leading tour operator providing a wonderful range of exclusive small group shared tours for those over 50, along with customizable private tours to both popular and off-the-map destinations throughout this beautiful and diverse country. If you're interested in experiencing one of their unforgettable journeys through Colombia, be it a shared tour with like-minded travelers or creating a unique private package of your own, just complete the form on the Columbia Calling website, that's www.columbiacalling.co, or the BNB Columbia Tours website, that's www.bnbcolumbia.com, and they'll be in touch within 24 hours to answer all of your questions and to start the planning of your exclusive Colombian adventure. So that's bnbcolumbia.com and latinnews.com. Thank you for supporting our sponsors.
I'm Emily Hart, and these are your headlines for the week of August 21st, 2023. An earthquake measuring 6.1 on the Richter scale hit Colombia on Thursday, with its epicenter just a few kilometers east of Bogotá in Meta. The quake was followed by 41 aftershocks, some as big as 5.6 on the Richter scale. Two houses and a bridge were destroyed near the epicenter, and one woman died in Bogotá after falling from a building. Landslides were also reported in Meta. 55 new indictments have been announced in the Colombia chapter of the Odebrecht corruption case, all accused of collaborating with the criminal network that the Brazilian multinational set up in order to rig public infrastructure contracts. The crimes charged against the new group include conspiracy, money laundering, and illicit enrichment. The Odebrecht case is one of the biggest corporate corruption cases in history and a story which broke more than 5 years ago. Damages were over 514 billion pesos, around $130 million, of which only $4 million have been recovered. This announcement by the Attorney General's office comes just days after Colombian business group Aval, Odebrecht's partner, admitted to the US justice system that it had paid bribes. The Colombian group, which belongs to the Sarmiento Angulo family, reached an agreement to cooperate with the justice system, and its directors will not face criminal charges. Next month, witnesses are scheduled to be heard in the Odebrecht case over the death of Jorge Enrique Pizano, auditor of an Odebrecht infrastructure project in Colombia, who died in strange circumstances after denouncing Aval. President Gustavo Petro has warned that if ministers want to remain in the cabinet, they have 1 month to show results of their budget expenditure. Consequently, the ministers of Agriculture, Transport and the Interior have asked for the formal resignation of numerous subordinates. The delays in execution of budget this year, to which Petro refers, may cause issues for allocation of next year's budget, though, according to some ministers, the causes of these failures to allocate budget are linked to bureaucratic obstacles, which are normal in the first year of a new administration. Meanwhile, a group of local governors are calling for the resignation of Minister of the Interior himself, Fernando Velasco, saying that he does not respect regional needs and realities after he made comments in response to regional security concerns, accusing local politicians of sensationalism and opportunism in the face of upcoming elections. The criticism of Velasco comes in the wake of several entities expressing concern about violence in the run-up to regional elections in October. On Tuesday, the Ombudsman's Office presented a report indicating that there are at least 380 municipalities at risk of human rights violations during the electoral process. Following his announcement last week of an assassination plot against him, Colombia's Attorney General Francisco Barbosa has presented a petition to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, asking them to demand that the Colombian government implement measures to guarantee his safety and that of his family. Barbosa says he has submitted this petition because he does not trust Colombian institutions. He also accuses Petro's government of failing to take the plot against him seriously. He reported that the ELN guerrilla group, the Ejército de Liberación Nacional, had planned to have him murdered. The Constitutional Court has ruled in favour of a practice known as escrache, online reporting, usually on social networks, of cases of rape and harassment of women, usually including the name of the alleged perpetrator. A man subject to such a report brought a petition to have a Facebook publication retracted, and the court refused, saying that escrache is an exercise of freedom of expression and a legitimate mechanism for women to denounce publicly and through non-institutional means. The court did not, however, permit the sharing of private details of a person if that detail is not a matter of public interest. Petro has announced the renegotiation of the free trade agreement with the USA, last negotiated under President Álvaro Uribe, amid criticism that it gave too much power to the US. Colombia currently has 17 free trade agreements with various countries and organizations around the world. This renegotiation was among Petro's campaign promises. More than 40,000 children and adolescents have crossed the Darien Gap between Colombia and Panama this year, according to the country's ombudsman. This is an increase of 445% as compared to the same period last year. The increase in children and adolescents crossing reflects the dramatic increase in crossings generally, the majority of whom are from Venezuela, Ecuador, and Haiti. Those were your headlines for this week. Thanks for listening.
And we're back. This is Colombia Calling, episode 483. I'm Richard McCall here in Bogota, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And our very special guest this week is none other than Ricardo Cubides. Now, some of you who are Colombianists or have been observing or watching the conflict, the post-accord situation or what's going on in Colombia will know who Ricardo is. He's quite a big fish in what's known as CODES here in Colombia. He's the Coordinador Regional, so he's the regional coordinator for the Caribbean region, which of course is an immense region of Colombia, for CODES. And this is the Consultorio para los Derechos Humanos y el Desplazamiento, so the consultation for human rights and displaced people. So an incredibly important, incredibly well-known organization, NGO, which works with victims on the ground, and he is obviously based in the Caribbean region. We're very lucky to have him on the line from Santa Marta at the moment. He is writing a book with CODES and with the National Historical Center for Memory, so the Centro Nacional de Memoria Histórica, and it's called The Profundos Silencios del Canal del Dique, so the deep silences of the Canal del Dique. So we're going to talk today with Ricardo about, well, this region of Colombia, and this region of Colombia that has been so severely strafed by the conflict and continues to this day to be majorly affected, but also underrepresented when it comes to news reports or even, let's say, just basic human rights in the region. I've talked too much. I'm just going to say now, so Ricardo Cubides, thank you so much for coming on the Colombia Calling podcast.
Thank you, Richard. For me, it's an honor to be in this podcast.
No, it's our honor, and I know that you've been practicing your English for this. So I'm going to speak as clearly as possible, and we're going to get through this, and we're going to get the information across about what's going on. So perhaps you could start by telling us a little bit about CODES and this NGO for whom you work.
Claro. Okay, CODES is the consultory for the human rights and displacement in Colombia. We have a lot of work for more than 30 years. And we usually try to be close to the communities who has victims of this conflict. And we now made some kind of project to help them to restore his rights.
Mm-hmm. It's the rights in the region of the traditional communities found in all of this area. And of course, when we talk about this area, we're talking Caribbean coast, we're talking the tourism centers of Santa Marta, obviously Cartagena, other beach areas, but I think more importantly, the interior of the Caribbean coast. So as we come several hours in around the Montes de Maria, some of you will remember the conversation I had some episodes ago with Angie Lederach, talking about her work for over a decade there. So I want to talk about this region because you study it very, very deeply. And let's mention some towns and cities. Is it Arjona, Cartagena, Calamar, Maria la Baja, Huamo, and San Onofre? These are all incredibly affected areas by armed groups and human rights abuses. Perhaps you could tell us about the geography and what's going on here.
Okay. Well, the name you say is the names of some towns was close to the Canal del Dique. It was a big structure they made the colonials stage. Mm-hmm. Is very old. They began to build maybe in the 16th century, mm-hmm. 400 years ago. And the Spanish crown,
isn't it?
The Spanish crown uses the force of the slaves, African slaves, or Africans in condition of slaves, or say in the better way, and others, indigenous people from Colombia, to make this big structure. Who connect the city of Cartagena, who was the center of the region in this time, from this region of the Caribbean, and the city of Bogota, mm-hmm. use the river, the Magdalena River.
Okay. So this...
And they have, the structure have 115 kilometers.
Wow.
It's a long way. But in the beginning was only lakes, and they just put in some kind of ways, some kind of routes between a lake and another lake. We call ciénagas. I don't know the name in English, but they just put together the ciénagas, use the some kind of river ways. Mm-hmm. And then in this work, many slave people have died, and others they just run away from this condition, and begin to build their towns. Mm-hmm. Certainly, the first Palenque was in the close to the Canal del Dique. Mm-hmm. He was built for a hero of the black people, Afro-Colombian people, who the name who was Benco el Viejo. Mm-hmm. And then he go to the other town close to the dique too. Now we know how the name now is San Basilio de Palenque.
Mm-hmm.
And we recognize this town who was the first one in the Americans who built a town from the the resistance of the slave people in Latin America. So this region have many times in resistance, many centuries, and with when the Republic comes, the circumstances don't change so much. The people still be discriminated from the new government, from the criollos government, and the modernity of the Caribbean, they don't come in the same way and to the other places. And we have many inequalities in all this region, and many and other factors of violence, structural violence, and the people have living always in something like a structural racism in this part. When he go to try to get his rights, they don't have a good answer from the government.
It's a tough one, isn't it? We start at the beginning. So you know, slaves are used, African slaves are used, and indigenous people are used in the construction of this 115 kilometers joining lakes for what is now the Canal del Dique, so a channel that connects the Magdalena up to Cartagena. And what I see is every decade or every century, it's a repetition of the same situation of structural racism that's taking place. But also, I find it this is fascinating, the what you say about slaves escaping and therefore making their own communities like San Basilio de Palenque. But of course, there are other towns as well, deep into the Montes de Maria, deep beyond where we go, but you obviously go, which are in the same situation. I suppose they don't have running water, electricity, healthcare, schools. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about some of those small towns in the, let's say, the Montes de Maria Profunda.
Yeah, in all this region, the situation is the same. Close to the Cartagena, maybe something like 50 kilometers, there are three communities. They are now recognized like African, Colombian African communities, Afro-Colombian communities. One is Rocha, another one is Lomas de Matunilla. And the other ones we know like Leticia. It's close to Cartagena, really little towns, and they are in the Canal del Dique, and Cartagena take the water from the Canal del Dique, but they don't have good water, potable water for you. They use directly the water from the canal, but not from the treatment el agua tratada que hace el acueducto de Cartagena, sino they use the water from the river, from the Canal del Dique. And so it's with all the things. They don't have saneamiento básico, they don't have good electricity, and they don't have enough schools, and for sure they don't have hospitals and puestos de salud.
Yeah.
And if you go to the go down to the river of the Canal del Dique, you can get the Montes de Maria. They are also another Black communities, Afro-Colombian communities, in the top of San Jacinto, in the close to the some lakes in Maria la Baja. Now that we have something like 30 Afro-Colombian communities. They call themselves comunitarios in this area. And if you will compare to the others towns, they don't have equals rights. Okay? They don't have water like the others. They don't have electricity. They are so away from the schools. The children go in maybe some mules or another kind of transportation, rural transportation, for hours to get to school. Wow. And so this is the reality now in the Canal del Dique and the Monte de Maria for the towns of the Afro-Colombian people.
I it will seem like a simple question, but you are the expert. Why today is this still the case that these communities suffer so much?
The people really don't think about this, but it's a structural racism. Mm-hmm. And they don't try the same because they are black people, and they don't provide the same things to them. You see, like, they're so far away, and they don't, the political who have the power now, they don't usually work with this kind of meaning, this kind of thinking that we must try to protect the right of the black people, who was in disequal proportion development than the others. Mm-hmm. And so we stayed still the same in this moment. And with the conflict, this become worse always. It's like the disequalities with the conflicts always go wrong, go worse.
Got worse. So there, you talk about the structural racism. We can talk about the big landowners and the big industries. You know, these people are, I guess, considered as, I would also say, descartable is, I think I would say, is a word. You know, almost, you know, not even recognized in the area. You mentioned the conflict, and I think this is a good segue into it. The chronology of the conflict and the armed groups in this area, it shows itself as being a central flashpoint for all of the problems, and many of the problems obviously that started at the very beginning, but now the problems today. Perhaps you could tell us one by one which of the groups have been in power in this area.
Yeah, the Caribbean has some particularities with the history of the conflict in Colombia. Certainly, they have two regions difference with different histories in this part. The Montes de Maria, who have guerrillas maybe in the beginning of the decade of the 70s. Mm-hmm. But maybe they have another kind of political influencia in the 60s, of the 60s, but they don't come until the 80s. And the first one was the EPL, Ejército Popular de Liberación.
Sí.
And then they come the LN, the National Liberation Army, and then the Revolution Armed Force from Colombia, the FARC, all in the same time, the the beginning of the la década de los 80, 1980, 1982, there was like a strategy from the guerrillas who was in the middle of the country, in the south of Bolivar, and some ones in Santander. They come to the Caribbean in this time in the same ways. Some one of them come to the Monte de Maria, others go to the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta, was the territory who have some kind of characteristics who they can live there, they can use the nature of the for try to go up in guerrilla war, mm-hmm. or say in a way. Yeah. And in the beginning of the 90s, they begin to be a really crisis war in all the Monte de Maria. Mm. But this is a part of the history because in the other way, they always the communities always was suffering a structural violence because the Lord lands they always have some armies, private armies, and they take the lands from the people of the four people who was I don't know how you say it in English, but los que rompieron la frontera agrícola al principio, los que abrieron los caminos de los lands,
who sort of
reclaimed these lands like ours, and they used the all the state to take the these lands and put away the farms. And we call that structural violence, yeah, yes. From the was before the conflict, yeah, they was used the force of the day, but they don't have guerrillas in this time. Mm-hmm. When come the guerrillas, and they put another kinds of violence control, land control, control territorial, and they begin to make some kind of how you say sequestro,
kidnapping,
yes. And extortion and some selective assassinations, all in the way of the strategy of war. One of the dynamic of the violence was to control the communities or the organization of the communities, and others to take money and to try to power in these regions. And so in the other way was a big one project from the state with who was helping with for was helping for of USA, mm-hmm. was the paramilitary project, and they go bigger in the middle of the 90s with the in this region, and I must say that the war is coming late to the Caribbean, and the paramilitary is coming late to the Caribbean too. The war in the rest of the country began maybe in the end of the violence, bipartite violence, we say, in something like the end of the fifth, the década de los 50, the 50 decades. And in the Caribbean, the guerrillas come in the 80s. And the big project paramilitary, not the little one, armies from the Lord Lars, you know, the big one project who was respaldo from the government and from the power, you say, in this moment, and was a continental strategy. They come in the 90s, 1996, something like this. And when they come, the crisis was really, really unbelievable. It was we talk about hundreds of massacres and millions of displaced people. And so in these years in the Montes de Maria, we have the worst time from the conflict. 1996 until 2002, something like this. In 2005, the paramilitary has a process of
the demobilization.
Then begun the sometimes like a peace period or something like a stabilization period. And the end of the guerrilla in the Montes de Maria was with the death of the comandante Martin Caballero of the FARC. In the end of many, and a big one process of many operation, military operation, who was together paramilitaries and the army. And in the end, they put away the guerrillas, something like 2008 or something. And the Montes began to have something like a stabilization moment. But it was not the end of the conflict. But when we talk about Canal del Dique, it's totally different. The war really was not coming until the end of the 90s.
Really?
Yes, it's totally different because they are so close to the Cartagena, and they are in this region. They live the most powerful people of this kind of this region, the elites from Cartagena, and the other they have something combat in the 80s with the guerrilla, but in the places who was close to the Montes de Maria or close to the south of Atlantico, but really close. Combats, one or three combats in some regions of, in the, how you say, the high cuenca of the Canal del Dique.
Okay, yeah,
close to the Calamar or something like this, but they really feel the war in 1999, and come the paramilitaries and make the massacres. And they really know that in this place they could grow up because they can make some alliance with the elites, but also they can make some alliance with narco traffic and with diff of combustible,
fuel
combustible. Because they are really close to the
pipeline
refinery.
Have you ever thought about visiting or even moving to Colombia's lush and welcoming Coffee Axis? We at Coffee Axis Travel can provide a personalized service from before your arrival to guide you through the process of setting up a new life here in Colombia's coffee region. We will help you find a place to live, help you navigate contracts and leases, advise you on your visa application and how to open a bank account, and more. With over 10 years of experience in this region, Erin Donaldson, originally from Reno, Nevada, can provide unrivaled knowledge about an area in which she is unashamedly passionate. Check out www.coffeeaxistravel.com for further information on half-day or full-day lifestyle tours and any bespoke consulting required in setting up your new life in Colombia. That's www.coffeeaxistravel.com, where you can get in touch.
And Reficar, the refinery, and
of course they take a lot of petroleum and a lot of oil of this refinery.
Before you continue, I have a couple of questions, and I know it's tough. So when we talk about the robbing of fuel, we're talking about from the Caño Limón Covenas pipeline as well. So, you know, the scandal that has come out now has been going on forever about the theft of fuel on that and then through the refinery. And then the other thing that I wanted to ask is in 2006 with the like Acuerdo de Ralito, you know, the sort of accords, the peace accords in inverted commas with the paramilitaries, did this improve things in the Montes de María and Canal del Dique? I mean, did it really mean that the paramilitaries demobilized in the area?
Yes. I was working with the Commission of Truth.
Yeah.
And I interviewed some paramilitaries and public interviews, mm-hmm. and they recognized then they have a strategy to take the oil from this the tube.
Yeah.
The pipeline. the pipe. and then they say, nos tomamos la gasolina del tubo,
mm-hmm.
close to Cartagena. They was not the first one group. They put away another group who was usually doing that maybe for 20 years or something like this. But when in the end of the night, when they come to this region, they control all the economies, the legal and illegal economies. And they was one of this economy, the economy of the illegal robo de gasolina.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you say exactly in English because it's pretty strange practice.
I don't
take the oil from the pipeline. Yeah.
And this is just putting like a tap, right, on the pipeline. It's like a grifo, and they just take it out. Amazing.
But they have many trucks to do this. Special trucks, mm-hmm. and they do they have files of these trucks. All the in it's close to Arjona, and they put the a special glyph on the pattern, and they come every day 20 or something like these cars, special cars, cisterna cars for take the oil,
and this is.
They do it with an alliance with people from the estatal company.
Yeah.
They say when. And they have many alliances in this place. We talk about all about this with these paramilitary chiefs, and they tell us how they have the report of the army infantry from the USA. Mm-hmm. To take away the cocaine from Canal del Dique to the sea was incredible. They have every day they take a map with the position of the boats and everything.
Mm.
It was really it's impressive what they do in this region.
So some of the interviews you did with these demobilized paramilitaries then have shown a total what we would say, infrastructure for illegality organized through the narco trafficking, organized through robbery of fuel, organizing the wealthy elites in Cartagena and the Costa to transport, let's say, cocaine, fuel out of this region and then for sale elsewhere. So they had maps of where, I guess, the army or the police were stopping vehicles, and so they would go a different way. Every day they knew. Every day.
Yeah, every day. And not only the maps from Colombia, also the maps of from the the army of USA to they made the interdiction.
It's a completely structural situation, as we say, infrastructure of illegality that I suppose continues today.
Yeah, of course. And okay. It's not only the people of the world, normal people who try to understand what is the how they put the cocaine in the USA or in Europe. They think in the how you say the speedboats.
Yeah, the speedboats
on the coast. But there's really the important characteristic of the dedicate is in the end the end of the decade is in the port of Cartagena, and really they uses to take the cocaine to the big ones, but they're not using only the little ones. They use the big ones, the containers.
Yeah,
what? And they have a lot of how you say burros in the city of Cartagena. The mafia has these burros and they control everything there today.
Of course, that's where the real money is in putting the cocaine in the tankers.
It's a big one, Mercado.
Yeah.
Only with legal boats you can sort this.
Yeah. This is terrifying to me that it all takes place in this one area, let's say. And this is, again, this comes down, we can concentrate it to the Canal del Dique again. And, you know, Wade Davis talks about the Magdalena River. He talks about it in his book. We had him here on the show, being Colombia's cemetery, a cemetery for Colombian people. And it makes unfortunate and grotesque sense that it is a cemetery in the Canal del Dique because of the corruption and criminality taking place. So people are getting very, very powerful and wealthy through the suffering and through the geography of this area, through the suffering of the people. And you said earlier that, you know, things really got bad in 1999, we had Andrés Pastrana was president until 2002. Yes. So why did it get really bad in 1999?
Yeah, the paramilitary project, they go bigger in this,
they
in
got
this
bigger.
Time. Yeah. From many things, from many different variables.
Uh-huh.
One of them was the alliance with the government to fight against the FARC, who was in the process with Pastrana.
Mm-hmm.
But the other was they really go to the control of the narcotraffic routes of all of these regions.
Mm-hmm.
For the paramilitaries, the first one who was come here was Vicente Castaño, the principal chief, and they saw the importance of this region to take this or to control this of economies, and they put many force to control all these. How you say all these all the movements of these kind of groups who was there, and also what happened is in this moment I will say in Spanish.
Yeah,
es en estos momentos un digamos un avance muy fuerte de los paramilitares en contra de los movimientos sociales.
Okay,
so digamos estrategia de terror basada en la limpieza social.
Okay,
y con alianza con el ejército, y esto lo han dicho los paramilitares muchas veces. Y una buena parte fue llevar o desaparecer todas las personas que ellos consideraron enemigos.
Mm-hmm.
Y este lugar para ellos era perfecto porque siendo unas tierras olvidadas, como lo veníamos diciendo, que parten como del structural racism que estaba puesto en práctica en este lugar, nadie decía nada.
Okay, I'm going to translate just for a second. So, like, because that was really important. So, So what was happening was it was a major increase in the paramilitary actions against social movements in these areas. So there was an increased campaign of terror, violence, social cleansing, most horrible term, limpieza social, social cleansing of the area, massacres, and so on, in order to control the area because they understood the value and the importance of this infrastructure there, obviously for the illegal economies. And at the same time, I can't remember where we were going with this, but at the same time, they understood. So it was something that, because of the abandon and because of the structural racism, when you look at the area and the state looking at the area, because of course the people and the communities living there, the government, the state, whomever's there, could look the other way, could look away while this is happening because there's no importance placed on this region. I mean, Ricardo, I don't know how you work on this the whole time, because it's so heavy. This is it's really tough. You know, when I was researching, I know a fair bit about this and have written about things and so on. But when I was researching some of the stuff you sent me, I had to watch little bits at a time, because to read it all and to watch it all in one go was too emotionally distressing. How do you deal with the emotions of all of this pressure and violence and listening to the people and knowing them? Because I think you are very connected to these communities. You know, I'm certain you go through periods where, you know, you get a phone call in the morning and they say your friend has been killed. You know, what are we going to do? How do you deal with this?
Well, it was really something that I just do it because I can't let to do. Yeah. When I was in the first time there, with the Commission of Truth of Colombia, in a map, in the Caribbean map, when we have something like information, some informants from the National Memory Center sentence from the justice, and in the canal of Dique was nothing. Mm. And then we decided to go there because the lighting was really suspicious. Nobody was there. Mm. And when I, the first time, I don't believe it. And I just I can just let this big thing without make a big work there. And we, in the commissioners, we put something like 10 persons to begin to walk the canal community for community and listen to the people. And in 2 years of really hard work, and then we begin to work with the victimaries, with the paramilitaries who recognize these crimes. And then that most important thing of this work was the victims and the victimaries. They say, yes, this happened. And we recognize the terrible thing that they do it. Mm. Now in the system of peace of Colombia, result from the accord from FARC, we have a system of truth. You have the Jurisdicción Especial para la Paz, HEP, the Commission of Truth, the Comisión de la Verdad, and La Unidad, the Unity, the search people who was disappeared. Unidad de Búsqueda de Personas Desaparecidas. Mm-hmm. This institution say that We have more than 9,000 people in this river.
9,000 people disappeared in the river.
Yeah. The Commission of Truth, I was the principal, the leader of the investigation, but I never can say the number because it is impossible. But the Unidad de Búsqueda, they have their methodology and they say this number. It was really amazing. You can't believe this.
In just this region of the Canal del Dique?
This 115 kilometers. You have three French paramilitaries, one close to the Cartagena, was in the middle and was in the south of the canal. In the middle, they take the people who was in the, I don't know how you say, because it's very bad to say limpieza social. This is a wrong way to say
it. Because it's a social... social cleansing sounds, nice, it's basically targeted assassinations. I mean,
it's assassination.
Yeah,
from the people who have some precarious conditions, like crazy people, but also the social leaders and all the paramilitaries can think like this was wrong. They take it and they assassinate it and they put it in the river. In the middle of the canal, they take the people from Barranquilla. The north of the canal, they take the people from Cartagena. Most of the people who was murdered there, they are not from the river of the canal, from the communities of the rivers. They come to the Monte de Maria, to the Barranquilla, Sincelejo, Cartagena, and other places. And many people from the own paramilitaries or narcotraficants from vendettas.
So I mean, the number is extraordinary, and I mean totally awful. If you say more than 9,000 people, this is I don't like making obvious comparisons, but I'm now getting this feeling of the dictatorship in Argentina throwing the people out over the River Plate. It's the same, the same kind of project.
It's incredible. More people than the Argentina.
Oh yeah, much more, many more in Colombia. But so we have to start bringing this conversation to an end. But I think what my listeners would like to know, and what I would like to know, is, well, what is the situation now? Because I suppose the people in charge are the Clan del Golfo right now. I suppose that they're in charge. So what is the situation right now in the area of the Canal del Dique?
One of the other big difference between Montes de Maria and Canal del Dique was that the paramilitaries never go.
They never left.
They never left. Then the reason, because the silence, you can explain it. It always have a control paramilitary and the alliance with the big lord lands and another elites. They have big projects, agro projects and fish projects and something like this. Camarones, something like big ones, production of this. And they stay there until now. And the Montes de Maria can tell them history, and they reveal some kind of social structure that they become to try to go to the love of victims and restitution de tierras, like this. But in the Canal del Dique, was never happened something like this. And in the beginning was the same paramilitaries and come another, like Rastrojos or the group of 40, many groups, many names. They come together in the Clan del Golfo. But now we have a big one problem, because the Clan del Golfo also go to the Montes de Maria. We have the worst time in until the end of the conflict with the FARC in this part. They begun, they take control of the land, they put rules to the communities, they take the young people, I'd say,
recruit
the young people again, and now we have a panorama, the worst panorama. We are made some big denuncias to, but it's really complex because the government now wants to make peace with everyone, but they are never was against the army or the government. They always murder people and the social security, and they still do it the same.
Yeah,
and they say we are in the cessar fuego, ceasefire, but what ceasefire there was never put fire with the army, and they always control the people. But now, not only in the Canal del Dique, but also in the Montes de Maria.
It seems like the situation is so very complex, as you said, fraught. The violence doesn't go away. The people remain in a situation of misery, poverty. They are completely abandoned, not only by the state, they're controlled by the armed groups who are obviously working parallel with the army and also with the local land holders, land owners, and so on. I don't understand how anything can get better. This is my massive
dynamic change in Montes de Maria, because in the Canal del Dique they always put the people over under control.
Mm.
Yes, put rules, and they don't want to the people go away. And the Montes de Maria, they make massacres to put the people away, to displace the people and take the lands. Huh. But now the paramilitaries, I think they learn. They have a mistake in the process of pass.
Mm-hmm.
They have the chief in USA or something like this. And now they don't make displacement, but they confinamiento. They confine the people in the Montes de Maria to take more power to negotiate peace with this government.
This is
a terrible thing that happened. We must put away more than, Codes put away more than 10 leaders in the last year from Montes de Maria, because they have amenazas from the Candelor.
This last statement might be the most important one so far. Everything you've said has been incredibly important, but you say that the paramilitary, so the Clan del Golfo, they've extended their authority, their power along this area, Montes de Maria, obviously Canal del Dique, but they are no longer doing displacement because it allows for them to control the communities and negotiate. And you mentioned with their leader in the United States, I can only imagine you're talking about Salvatore Mancuso.
No, I don't think they have a connection, but they learn about their wrongs, their mistakes.
Okay.
We can make a peace like this. We must be like FARC. We must, te voy a decir en español, nosotros tenemos que demostrar que tenemos un poder sobre las comunidades, que somos beligerantes para aparecer como en un proceso en ese, y no como lo hicimos antes, que parecíamos como una alianza con estos y nos traicionaron. Entonces ahora están como en esta estrategia, y lo que nos han puesto es sacar líderes amenazados todo el tiempo. Nosotros hemos estado con mucho más peligro en el último año. Es muy, muy, muy difícil lo que está viviendo Montes de María ahora.
So what they're trying to do is obviously
you know, they dominate the communities, get rid of the social leaders, but show that they have a like a politically belligerent force within the community so that they can come to a negotiating table just like the FARC did in the peace accords, rather than a military group with parallel aims alongside the armed forces and so on. And they felt that they were betrayed in the 2006 accords, I think, is what you're saying there. So now this time they want to appear like political actors instead of, an armed gang. Ricardo, I think we could talk for hours, but I think we've got enough information for now. But when will your book, Profundos Silencios del Canal del Dique, when will that be published?
This is the name. We put it in codes, but we are now make an alianza with the National Center of Memory, and maybe in the beginning of the next year. Mm-hmm. We have the, I don't know the new name, but this is the name we began with this project something like 2 years ago.
Okay. So please invite me to the launch in 2024.
Of course.
I would like to be there to speak to people and to obviously read the book and so on. A very important work that you are doing to, continue to visualize and tell what is going on in this region. I can only assume, Ricardo, that you live in fear for your own life as well, because what you are doing is incredibly dangerous. So I'm just going to say, please, please, please look after yourself. Please be careful. You are no good to anyone if you're not alive. This is the truth.
For sure.
It's okay. You are no good. We need you to continue to tell the stories and to continue to compile the evidence so that people go to trial, so that people in these areas receive some kind of justice. But if you become just another number of, social leaders or activists, this is no good at all. So please be careful, Ricardo.
Thank you for the consensus. I will take it for sure.
All right. So we've been talking to Ricardo Cubides, who is the regional coordinator for the Caribbean area of CODES, that is the Consultorio para los Derechos Humanos y el Desplazamiento in Colombia. Now, this is a nationwide NGO, but Ricardo runs the Caribbean Center. This has been a pretty deep, pretty hard conversation to have, but we like to change things around here on the Columbia Calling podcast. And the aim has always been to try and share more information about Colombia, not just Colombians doing great things and elsewhere or people doing great things in Colombia, but we also need to stay up to date and current with some of the real tragedies taking place here. So for those of you who have been turned off by this, I apologize. But for those of you maybe in academia or maybe in journalism or maybe just incredibly interested in what's really going on in Colombia, then hopefully we have been able to, shed some light on a terrible situation. Let me just say thank you again to Ricardo Cubides for his time. I know that he was very nervous about his English, but he got all the messages across. I think we understood him very, very well. So we're going to say thank you and goodbye. And of course, if you want to support the Columbia Calling podcast, you can go to patreon.com/Columbia Calling. And it's like a tip at the end of the month, which allows us to continue running the Columbia Calling podcast. Ricardo, thank you for your time.
Well, thank you. Okay. I really like this podcast.
Thank you again. So we'll be back next week with more interviews and conversations about Colombia. Thank you again. Bye-bye.
The Colombia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region, sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. We are also sponsored by BNB Colombia Tours, which is a leading tour operator providing a wonderful range of exclusive small group shared tours for those over 50, along with customizable private tours to both popular and off-the-map destinations throughout this beautiful and diverse country. If you're interested in experiencing one of their unforgettable journeys through Colombia, be it a shared tour with like-minded travelers or creating a unique private package of your own, just complete the form on the Colombia Calling website, that's www.colombiacalling.co, or the BNB Colombia Tours website, that's www.bnbcolombia.com, and they'll be in touch within 24 hours to answer all of your questions and to start the planning of your exclusive Colombian adventure. So that's bnbcolombia.com and latinnews.com. Thank you for supporting our sponsors.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.